KALW.
People really want this to be a road for cars. People really want this to be a park, and I think it's our precious coast.
Tensions are running high over San Francisco's Prop K.
We should be working together here, not going toe-to-toe. That's what's wrong with San Francisco.
The contested future of the Upper Great Highway. Then a community organization battles medical mistrust to foster better health outcomes.
Western medicine, in its framework, it teaches people that a physician or this healthcare worker knows your body better than you do.
And we honor Barbara Dane's 7 decades of revolutionary music making.
When you start to sing, don't be stuck in any genre, because it's not the style that's important, it's what you're singing about.
Highways, health, and heroism. That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. San Francisco's Upper Great Highway is at a crossroads. The 2-mile road sits between the city's Sunset neighborhood and the western edge of the Pacific coastline. During COVID lockdowns, the road was shut down to provide more outdoor areas for people to gather. Today, a compromise opens the road for vehicles on weekdays and closes it for people on the weekends. But that arrangement is coming to an end on December 25th. And once again, the city will have to decide what to do with the Great Highway. One possibility will be on voters' ballots in the form of Prop K, which would permanently close the road to private vehicles to establish a park. To help voters understand the arguments for and against the proposition, KLW held a panel at 220 Montgomery, our live event space, with stakeholders that are for and against Prop K. On the yes for Prop K side is Friends of Great Highway Park Board President Lucas Lux and the author of Prop K, District 4 Supervisor Joel Engardio. On the no for Prop K side is District 1 Supervisor Connie Chan and Open the Great Highway spokesperson Richard Correa. The panel was moderated by KLW executive producer Ben Trefney. This excerpt begins with Richard answering a listener question on where the data comes from that supports the claim that closure of the Upper Great Highway would slow down average commutes. Here's Richard.
Yes, the June 18th, or amended to July 8th report by Rec and Park does show slower times traversing the Lower Great Highway. But in the last 5 years, there's been 4 accidents on the Upper Great Highway. And if you look at it, to force traffic off of that, those 14,000 cars are going somewhere, and they're going onto high injury corridors and streets that have a lot more than 4 in a 5-year period. Someone could prove me wrong here, but I'll bet you the Great Highway is one of the safest thoroughfares in the entire city. Okay. No intersections.
So you mentioned the traffic on the Lower Great Highway, which is one of, if you know the west side of San Francisco, it's a grid. There's the Upper Great Highway, the Lower Great Highway, and then 48th, 47th, 46th, all the way up to Sunset, which is the main thoroughfare. So the Lower Great Highway is one option. I wanted to note something that I spoke, we're going to get more to traffic issues in a second, because I spoke with San Francisco Municipal Transit Agency head Jeffrey Tumlin this morning with some other points around traffic, just to bring it up so we could discuss it, because I know the traffic is one of the biggest concerns, as you mentioned, Richard. But let's go to you, Lucas.
Yeah, so with respect to Supervisor Chan and my friend Richard, they say they need more time for studies because they don't like the results of the studies that we've had. We have years of data, multiple transportation agencies have studied this, and they have concluded what we all knew all along the way. And that is because the Great Highway closes all the time because of sand, up to 65 days a year. So we have real-time data on what happens to all the trips that rely on the Great Highway to get from the outer Richmond to Daly City. That's the only impacted trip. And we know that on those days, it takes 3 minutes longer with present conditions, not a single roadway improvement. That is. I don't know if we're allowing audience shouts, but for the listeners, someone said I'm wrong, and that just reinforces the point. We have the public institutions to study and measure this data. I trust our public institutions to measure something as simple as how many cars use a road, And it's 14,000, not 20,000. Richard needs to update his numbers. And that's 38% decrease on the Great Highway. Similarly, in trip times, the impact with no improvements, similar or existing conditions, is 3 minutes. So the question for voters is, 3 minutes under current conditions, is that an acceptable trade-off for an oceanfront park?
Just as a follow-up, where did the, and Supervisor Chan, I'll get to you in just a moment, where does the information come from where it says the commute difference is 3 minutes?
So that's from the MTA report. It'll tell you that under current conditions, it's 3 minutes longer to get, you can look at their trip data from the Outer Richmond to Daly City. Other trip times are not impacted.
Okay, thank you. Supervisor Chan.
Well, first of all, I did not indicate that we need more study. In fact, I quoted a study saying that a compromise can be done. That's a study that was issued by CTA, confirmed by Stacey Bradley, that was issued in 2021. What I'm saying here, though, is that with that study, we know a compromise can be done. The question here is why that cannot be the case. Why are we making an argument about this that has to be on the ballot and that has to be a binary choice that San Franciscans have to make? It really is, there is not a lot, be it the traffic, be it at the park, what is it that we can convince everyone that the current status quo is not good enough? The fact that it is the third most popular park, I think that's great. That means it's working as it currently status. So why not keep it as it is if it's already the third most popular park? So, you know, on the weekend. And then on the weekdays, that people can actually still use it for vehicle access.
So thank you for that. And I think that that's a question for you, Supervisor Engardio, because you brought this to the ballot. Why make this a binary choice at this point?
Right. So compromise is great. It has worked for a while, but ultimately it'll leave everyone unsatisfied because basically on Monday morning you got to roll back the park for the cars and you can't have infrastructure like a seating for seniors or whatnot. So you can never really have a proper park. And then if you share it with the road, you know, during the week, you know, it's Monday through Friday till noon. People wanted the Friday commute, but already the Board of Supervisors rejected that 9-2 to not allow the Friday commute. So ultimately, the compromise is not sustainable. And then trying to share the road of one lane in each direction and a park as well could create like the most unsatisfying experience for everyone because the driving experience won't be great. You kind of poke along. The park experience won't be great. And it turns out to be the most expensive option because of the infrastructure needs for that to happen. So people really want this to be a road for cars. People really want this to be a park. And I think it's our precious coast and it's reasonable to let the people decide what to do with this section of the Great Highway.
Those were District 4 Supervisor Joel Engardio, Friends of Great Highway Park Board President Lucas Lux, District 1 Supervisor Connie Chan, and Open the Great Highway spokesperson Richard Correa. They spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney. You can find the hour-long panel discussion and all our election coverage at kalw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. For some BIPOC people, dealing with the healthcare system can be tough. Discrimination, lack of cultural understanding, and mistreatment can all lead to skepticism of the medical system. In Oakland, health organizations like Freedom Community Clinic are responding to this long-standing issue. KALW's Daniela Rodriguez brings us the story of how this one community organization strives to foster trust and better health outcomes.
Every breath, releasing any tension in your shoulders.
Kendall Dominique is leading a peaceful breathing exercise.
She's an herbalist in residence at Freedom Community Clinic, and she's running a workshop called To Be Held.
To Be Held by Herbs requires us to dive into our understanding of what healing looks like outside of this Western ideology, right? We're having to step into a different vision of what medicine looks like.
There are about 15 participants, mostly people of color.
Hi, come in, it's okay. Come on in, just grab a mask and sit where you pretend.
This workshop was designed to help immunocompromised folks learn about different herbs that can help them.
And so today we're focusing on exploring herbs that support our immune system as well as support in regulating inflammation in our bodies.
In order to understand why Freedom Community Clinic exists, let me take you back a few years.
ABC7 presents Race and Coronavirus, a Bay Area Conversation.
The disease is disproportionately impacting Black Americans. Data is still...
During the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, people of color were dying at much higher rates than their white counterparts. In May of 2020, the city of Oakland passed a resolution declaring a local health emergency for African American residents due to the spread of COVID-19. 2 years later, the city declared racism a public health crisis.
Racism is now a public health crisis in Oakland. The city council voted unanimously to pass the measure this week. And for more on what this means for Oakland...
The pandemic accentuated the health disparities between communities of color and white populations. It also brought broader attention to the persistent issue of medical mistrust. According to a 2021 study published in the Annals of Family Medicine, people of color were way more likely to distrust healthcare professionals than the white people surveyed. Latinos were nearly 50% more distrustful, and African Americans were more than 70% more distrustful. Now, medical mistrust can stem from historical events. The U.S. Public Health Service's syphilis study of men at Tuskegee Institute was infamous. Mistrust can also come from people's personal experiences with medical institutions. But in this study, the researchers suggested that the mistrust was due to implicit and institutional racial and ethnic bias in health professionals.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
In Oakland, the staff at Freedom Community Clinic knows those problems well.
I come from a family that has experienced a lot of medical trauma.
Dr. Bernadette Lim is the founding executive director of Freedom Community Clinic.
And my mom and a lot of my family members growing up would have a lot of encounters in the medical system in which they felt traumatized and they felt like they did not have a voice and that they had to undergo procedures that they didn't have full consent towards and even resulted in death for some of my family members.
Dr. Bernadette remembers her family hardly going to the doctor growing up.
I'm Filipino, and my mom would always say, you know, you have Vicks VapoRub, you have Sprite, you have Rose Caldo. Like, those are your doctors. And for the most part, you know, they really did help with a lot of issues. However, when she had a lot of her reproductive health issues, she had to go to the doctor, and that was very traumatizing for her because she didn't realize the full consequences of the hysterectomy procedure of not being able to have kids after. And that was so traumatizing to see growing up.
She remembers seeing her mother turn to home remedies from the Philippines.
Acupuncture, spiritual counseling, and the Filipino massage modality. And these modalities were able to be there and help her reclaim her body in ways that the medical system didn't.
With those memories in mind, Dr. Bernadette started the Freedom Community Clinic in 2019 and established an organizing team through 2020. This was both during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic and during Bernadette's time in medical school. She says she and her colleagues at Freedom Community Clinic see themselves as a healing frontline for community members who have been cut off from traditional healing.
Our ancestral medicines have been commodified and they have been divorced from their origins, such that we see herbal medicine, acupuncture, and yoga and meditation in these rich wellness spas and these places that are divorced from the actual communities and cultures of which they came from.
Dr. Bernadette says many people who visit Freedom Community Clinic explain that they have not felt seen or heard in the medical system. Western medicine in its framework, it teaches people that a physician or this healthcare worker knows your body better than you do. And I think the reality that we're trying to uplift at Freedom Community Clinic is you know your body and you know your healing journey better than anyone else.
Dr. Bernadette doesn't reject Western medicine. She knows it's saved a lot of people. But she says it's a both-and situation. There's no single source of healing that can be the answer for everyone.
I don't need that. And I'm just like, you know what? That is real.
A woman named Ellen is sitting across from me at the herbal workshop. She says she was diagnosed with lymphoma about 20 years ago.
It was relatively early, stage 2. But nonetheless, I underwent 8 months of chemotherapy. And the chemotherapy cocktail was 8 drugs every 2 weeks.
Ellen tells me that throughout her battle with cancer, she felt that Western medicine only addressed what was wrong in the present moment.
I am dealing with after effects of the treatments 20 years later, and they don't consider what you potentially will have as a result of the chemotherapy, the radiation.
Ellen is attending the herbal workshop as a way to have a more healing approach to her health. Across town in the Fruitvale neighborhood, I meet up with Esperanza Jimenez and Maria de Los Angeles at FCC's Sanctuary Space.
Hi, yeah, nice to meet you both of you.
As soon as I step into the building, I am greeted by a big colorful mural near the entrance. The building smells almost spa-like, infused with incense.
A lot of vibrant energy and abundance. There's also a lot of violence and harm that our communities experience. And so our intention at Freedom Community Clinic was to create spaces where communities can come and experience love, joy, safety, and healing.
Esperanza is the Director of Cultural Arts and Healing Sanctuaries at FCC. She takes me through their growing apothecary in the corner of the room. Esperanza preps a small brown bag with herbal blends. These infusions were selected by Promotoras de Sanacion, local community members who become health educators.
We have 3 blends, and these were made by our lovely promotoras, who are community workers themselves.
For this batch of herbs, it was a blend of rose, chamomile, and other herbs for feelings of anxiety.
Promotoras de Sanacion is a beautiful, very powerful program that we have at Freedom Community Clinic. It began last year, last summer of 2023.
Promotoras de Sanacion is based on a long-running program, Promotoras de Salud. That is a framework used in many health organizations and clinics. Esperanza says FCC's main goal is to train their promotoras in FCC's practices.
We train them in basic introductory workshops to herbal medicine, acupuncture, and massage.
The promotoras are Spanish speakers that come from El Salvador, Guatemala, Mexico, and Honduras.
Community receives and is very open to our services because it's directly coming from their neighbor or their comadre or someone that they know and they trust.
Surrounded by books in a kitchen, I sit with Maria de Los Angeles, who goes by Angeles. She is a promotora de sanación at FCC. She tells me what she has learned about the community since she first started.
Principalmente quizás sea porque son indocumentados, entonces...
Angela says she's learned that people's main fear of the healthcare system is related to their undocumented status and fear of deportation. On top of that, people in the community are sometimes unemployed, unhoused, and are held back by language barriers. Because of that, they don't know where to get medical services. She says the promotoras try to minimize fear in their community members by offering medical resources and a communal space they can trust. FCC founder Dr. Bernadette Lim says this is the goal of Freedom Community Clinic. In Oakland, I'm Daniela Rodriguez for Cross Currents.
Daniela is an alum of the KALW Audio Academy. You can find all of her work at kalw.org/crosscurrents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Singer, songwriter, and activist Barbara Dane died at the age of 97 in her Oakland home this past weekend.
Trouble in my
First is a word that comes up a lot with Dane. Her jazz chops earned her a 7-page story in Ebony back in 1959, making her the first white woman featured in the magazine. Dane started a nightclub where white audiences were introduced to the blues for the first time. She's influenced generations of singer-songwriters, some of whom may not even know her name. Today we remember her with this story from reporter Stephen Short, which first aired in 2012.
Okay, so here's how the round part goes. Seize the time, organize unity, their strength in love, try.
Singer Barbara Dane is leading a workshop called The Songs of Peace and War in a middle school auditorium. She sits rather than stand because at age 83, her physical stamina isn't what it once was. But you wouldn't know that by the sound of her voice. Today, Dane sounds much as she did in the 1950s when her first blues album was released. Her shoulder-length hair is now gray, but not that different from when Ebony magazine described her as startlingly blonde over a half century ago.
It's our great pleasure now to introduce to you Barbara Dane, Reverend Kirkpatrick, and Pete Seeger.
There was that time on the Mall in Washington, D.C., for instance, in 1971 during the Vietnam War with tens of thousands singing along on live television.
I don't want nobody over me. I don't want nobody over me. And I don't want nobody under me.
My name is Barbara Dane. I think, first of all, I'm a singer, and I've always been a singer. I'm a mom. I'm a producer. Well, overall, I'm a resistor, I guess.
Well, I'm on my way, and I won't turn back.
I try to be in my songs, something of an explainer sometimes, or a teacher, but resistance to just what people throw at you and expect you to swallow, I don't do that.
Dane not only sang for peace in Washington, D.C. in the 60s, she was also the first performer to break the U.S. travel ban to Cuba, where she was welcomed by Fidel Castro. In Italy, she was called the voice of the other America. In the U.S., it's not surprising that the popular singer was soon blacklisted from major folk festivals. What is surprising is this didn't happen because of her political activism. It was because she publicly criticized how festival management treated musicians. Additionally, Dane canceled major shows at the height of her popularity if her mixed-race band wasn't welcomed. She vividly remembers L.A. booking agent Charlie Barnett, who wanted her to drop bassist Wellman Bro, even though Bro had played for decades with the Duke Ellington Orchestra.
Well, so when he said you can't bring Wellman, what are you talking about? Well, those places get a lot of Texans, and they wouldn't go for having a white woman fronting a mixed band. And you know what I did? I just flat out said, "F you, Charlie Barnett," and I turned around and walked right out.
Racism can cut both ways, of course. The startlingly blonde Dane says eyes would turn when she entered black clubs to perform. But she says as long as she acted professionally, there were never any problems.
They say that freedom is a constant struggle.
Dane's activism led her to start a record label in 1970, a novel thing for a woman to do, then or now.
Was to give voice to millions of people around the world that were in struggle and had no way of, not many ways of communicating with each other and the rest of the world.
Absolutely unheard of. Even the business the way it is now, there isn't really anyone that accomplished as much as she did in terms of breaking barriers and standing up for what she believed in.
Stephen Short first reported that story in 2012. Barbara Dane died Sunday at the age of 97. You can hear more about her life and music at klw.org/crosscurrents.
Well, I'm going down the track. I got tears in my eyes, trying to read a letter from my home.
Today's CrossCurrents team includes Demetrius Johnson, Leon Morimoto, Crystal Rahim, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Molly Blair Salyer, Shirin Adil, Hanisha Herjani, Lisa Morehouse, Angela Johnston, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Sunni Khalid. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Dawood Anthony. For CrossCurrents, I'm Hannah Baba.
This train I ride on is 100 coaches long.